Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brown, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hello there, Guy. How are you?
I'm doing very well, but I have a question for you, Margaret.
Please do ask.
Margaret, it's also a statement. Margaret, jumpsuit?
Indeed.
I mean, Margaret is jumpsuiting really hard today.
Really hard. I mean, we've got like a flowy leg kind of situation.
There's a little tie at the bodice, which is selling things really nicely. Mm-hmm. We've got like orchids on black.
It's like elegant aloha.
Thank you very much, guys. Nordstrom is having a sale. I'm not working for them, but they are having an anniversary sale, and I would just say go and get some shit.
I would say in like classic 1987 style, you could date a knight that jumpsuit.
You could what?
You could date a knight that jumpsuit.
Date a knight.
No. Date a knighting. The process of putting on a higher heel and pearls.
Oh, of course.
Not that women ever wear pearls like this.
Right. But, you know, I've long been confused by day to night as the women magazines have laid it out because I don't understand the concept. Don't you at some point go home and change your clothes?
No. It's because when you're out in the city, you just don't. You don't go home. You don't take the train home. You just go day to night.
New York is a horrible place.
Yeah.
We've also got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, how is your week going?
My week has been fabulous. In fact, the Rocketeers will see this on our Instagram feed very shortly, but I had the opportunity to chat with Tracy Ellis Ross today.
That was pretty exciting. You're going to be guest hosting Bullseye.
I'm going to be guest hosting Bullseye, and I had a lovely conversation with Tracy. We're already fast friends, so I can't wait to share it all with everyone.
Oh, that's very exciting. That's very exciting. And you heard the voice before, but we have a very special guest. We are, like, really upping our game when it comes to guest panelists. It is the creator and showrunner of Unreal, Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
Woohoo!
Hello.
Hi, guys.
Sarah, tell us a little bit more about you.
I was a National Geography B champion in sixth grade.
All right, that's pretty exciting.
I wore a fedora to every day of sixth grade.
That's wonderful.
I thought it was adventurous. I had one guest shirt. I would also wear that because it was my only piece of designer clothing. And I started shopping at thrift stores when I was in sixth grade, too.
Now, look, we all love a geography bee.
We also, especially.
It's more than just knowledge. It's also about aesthetics. Because I'm sure that an 11 to 12-year-old Sarah Gertrude Shapiro could throw down with many world capitals. But which one was she excited to see come up?
Australia.
Just because Canberra is so unexpected.
Guess who moved to Canberra the next year? This guy.
Why the fuck did you move to Canberra?
Because I wanted to see it all. No, my father got a teaching job at ANU or something. Yeah, I moved there and I became a horse girl in Australia.
That's cool. That's a nice little interlude.
Yeah.
And you're wearing a bandana right now, which seems just
never
Australian to me.
No,
but,
that's right.
All right, so being transported, so where were you growing up until then?
Santa Barbara, California.
All right, so at least you were a California Jewess. So being presented to all of these sort of like athletic, blonde, like Australians at like a delicate time in a woman's life.
Very, very delicate.
Were you prepared for it or were you like, I got this, I'm from Santa Barbara?
No, I was like deeply unprepared. There were, you know, private school uniforms, public schools, private school, whatever. So there are all the uniforms and the weird tinted milks and the choco rolls and the shepherd's pie and all the weird rules and people were really rapey and there were kangaroos on campus.
Whoa.
Wow. That sounds like a new film project.
It's a solid pitch.
Yeah. I would see this immediately.
Well, I am fascinated. Thank you so much for being here. We have a lot of important things we're taking care of today. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be taking a look at Sacha Baron Cohen's new Showtime series, Who is America? And we're going to talk about the politics of comedy more generally. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But before that, two things. First of all, my goddamn book is coming out this week, you guys.
Boom, boom, boom.
Rocketeers, I need this from you. Please go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell's Books, your local bookstore. Buy My Life as a Goddess by Guy Branum. It's all of the glory and beauty that we have created here in Pop Rocket, but only me talking. but it really is something that, like, the people in this room, not Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, no offense, but the other people in this room and
no
you,
problem, mate.
And you guys at home sort of, like, really helped me make, and I appreciate it. But the we have three things to do. We also wanted to talk about a really significant voice here in Los Angeles, who we were all big fans of. Karen, tell us about Jonathan Gold.
Well, Jonathan Gold, essentially, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning, the first Pulitzer Prize winner to write in food criticism. But more than anything, he became, over the course of the last several decades, the unofficial ambassador of Los Angeles through his writing about food and food cultures that people tended to ignore, from immigrant communities to the things that you would find in strip malls and tucked away corners far away from the glittering scapes of Rodeo Drive and Beverly Hills or the West Side and these other places that people associate with a kind of glossy image of Los Angeles. He showed us not only a different set of places to eat, but how to eat and encounter, eat with and encounter people who are very different from who we may be ourselves. So I don't know. He is a profound and tremendous loss. His voice will be missed. He was a beautiful and eloquent writer. He used to write about music before he became a food critic. And I think that we're all very much in mourning in Los Angeles right now.
I remember hearing him on NPR talking about the book that he wrote about Pico Boulevard, and just that experience of taking this sort of rundown street that runs through LA and using it as a literal cross-section of who lives here and how we eat. And it was one of those things that was like fascinating anthropology, but also told me where the good cabrito was.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, like, the sense of discovery that you receive from Gold reviews, it wasn't touristic. It wasn't a kind of, I want to say kind of a colonizing or appropriative view of culture. He was very much, you know, I want to actually share some of his words. He says, "I'm trying to democratize food and trying to get people to live in the entire city of Los Angeles. I'm trying to get people to be less afraid of their neighbors." And I think that that was his ethos. And it very much, I think, created a new sociability, a new fabric to life in Los Angeles, his writing.
When I moved here in 2002, I think, like a lot of people, I was really intimidated by the scope of LA. It's such a ginormous metropolis. You don't know where to start. You don't necessarily have a reason in your mind to go visit certain places in the city because you're just kind of like, well, that's a random neighborhood some half an hour away from me. What am I going to go do there? But Jonathan Gold always gave you a reason to go somewhere new. You would find that one hole in the wall in the most rundown strip mall that served the spiciest, most delicious, crazy cuisine and say, go there. Now you have a reason to go to this little particular corner in Rosemead or wherever. And I always think of him when I go to Gelada, which is a restaurant in Hollywood, which I think he pretty much just put on the map 100%.
There were so many places he put on the map, so many businesses he saved of local business owners.
Yes.
I have to say, like, personal shout out to Tim and Jan Kinkali. I did not know about the world of Georgian soup dumplings. And now I do, and it was worth it.
Yeah. I mean, at Jitlada, there's a woman who has owned it for a long time named Jazz. And the minute you come in there, she'll usually ask you, how did you get here? How did you come? And a lot of people will say Jonathan Gold to her, which is the reason that she has, at least for a long time, she had on the tables, kind of underneath the glass, his absolute boffo review that he wrote about the place in LA Weekly. And Jitlada, for those of you who don't know, and if you come to LA, you should absolutely go there. It's this, again, in a strip mall, hole in the wall kind of place. It's in Thai Town. You go in, there is a exhaustive menu of all sort of specialties from Thailand all over, and things that you won't see at most Thai restaurants.
You've got frog leg options.
Yes, multiple frog leg options. Yeah. Multiple, like, southern cuisine, northern cuisine, like dry rub, sauces, like all kinds of things that are handwritten onto the menu. And so you go there and you order something and you feel confident, I think, that you know that Jonathan Gold has worked his way through most of this menu and loves it all.
I also saw some writing that I hadn't seen of his from after the LA riots that I was just really, really stunned by, really moved by. I don't know if you guys, have you read?
It's just, yeah, I mean, because he reflects on, like, having lived in Koreatown and just the sort of sense of alienation and the kind of burned outness of it, but then kind of holding on to this fragile hope and this tentative intimacy that he and his neighbors shared afterwards.
Yeah, and I think he was just really talking about that feeling of like almost being an intruder right after the riots. He went in for a meal and he said the food was just as good as ever, but I felt like crying.
Yeah.
And they were relieved when I left.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, he was really honest and he was really wise about being a white person going into spaces that weren't necessarily his to go into as just a tourist. He would go in deep. He knew better than to go in there as just a kind of casual diner who'd grab it and leave. He would really study the cuisine and study what they had to sort of communicate through their food.
It also had measurable benefits on the community. I mean, truly, like, I feel like there are so many of those things where sort of woke white people go into situations and they like do it quote unquote right, but the actual legacy of what they've done isn't necessarily the best.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you look at what he did to the people that he supported and really believed in, like, their lives measurably changed.
Yes.
Well, one point a friend made that I really appreciated was that the singularity of voice of what he did meant that he was able to be very specific. That if there were a committee deciding the 101 best restaurants in LA, it would have been a whole lot of Providence and not a whole lot of, you know, like, random...
Chengdu taste.
My question is this experience of tourism. And, like, I so frequently... Like, it was neat. I would go to a comedy show, and then I would go to a weird Fidelio place that showed me this, like, young, upscale, Hispanophone sort of nightlife going on in Whittier. And I felt weird being this person splashing into this place because this white guy told me to go there. But also, it was magical.
Yeah,
you know?
I feel like Vita had, like, an interesting scene about that. Like, the Warby Parker? That, like, she was like, vlogging from in front of a taco shop or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great scene in Vita. And I thought that they captured the complexity of it because I feel like my feeling on it is, like, there's probably not an answer.
Yeah.
But do you remember the scene, Karen? I'm talking about.
I don't really remember this.
Okay, so there's like an anti-gentrification character who's like an activist, and she comes by, and there's a white girl in Warby Parker glasses, like, vlogging from in front of a taco shop, being like, "Great new like taco find, whatever." She's screaming at her, being like, "Get the fuck out of our neighborhood!" Mm-hmm. And then the sister who's just returned is like, "Have you ever gone in there and spent any money yourself?"
Yeah.
And so I think there's like something about looking at the commerce of it. That was what I was so impressed with Jonathan Gold, is like, again, just looking at his economic legacy. It's undeniable. He did good for the communities he went into.
Yeah.
He didn't take, he gave, you know?
Rest in peace, our dear friend.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Now let's turn our attention to something truly serious. it's time for old business, everyone. A couple of weeks ago, I officially created a new segment and placed a name into consideration. The new segment is the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval, and the name placed into consideration was Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So let's open this up by just discussing the procedure of what we're doing here. First, I need to establish that there is a quorum of permanent Pop Rocket hosts. I will call attendance. Winter Mitchell. Winter Mitchell. Winter Mitchell is marked absent. Margaret Wappler.
Aye.
Karen Tongson.
Here, here.
Guy Branum. Here. All right. We have ourselves a quorum. Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, as a guest host, you have full rights and powers in debate, but no vote, okay?
Okay.
You are the equivalent of the non-voting delegate from the U.S. Virgin Islands to the
Congress. You
have
all the rights in the world, Sarah, but you cannot vote.
I've never felt so important.
Puerto Rico.
If you need a point of order, if you would like to move to the previous question, you can do all of those things.
Great.
You can also serve on committees. God, let's hope there are no...
Oh, God, could I?
...committees. All right, so... I am now going to officially make a case for Dwayne The Rock Johnson receiving the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval.
I just, like, scream at random or just let you?
You guys are encouraged to ask questions, to engage. Margaret, in the great tradition of the Vatican, you will be acting as the cineast's advocate.
That's correct.
The snob's advocate who says this person is not worthy of it. Also, we should probably explain what this made-up thing is. the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. We're saying we fundamentally agree with what this person does. We assume that there is going to be some degree of merit in most of their material. It's us giving a grand thumbs up to a celebrity or a work. Are we all ready?
Mm. We're ready.
Mm. All right. I will begin. Here's my case for Dwayne The Rock Johnson receiving the Pop Rocket seal of approval. Hey, he delivers on comedy, okay? Since the goddamn rundown, this guy has been providing us with consistent material. The Tooth Fairy. I mean, Pain and Gain, so good. Central Intelligence was amazing. Like Moana, Jumanji, this guy delivers. There have been a lot of guys who have tried to go from being strong action guy to being comedy guy. Some have worked like Schwarzenegger. Some have not worked like Stallone. Some were medium like Vin Diesel. But I would say that Dwayne The Rock Johnson is at least likable, even in something bad. I think that his WWE, this is my second point, his WWE training fundamentally is well disposed to our current era of celebrity. He is somebody who is a little bit always on, but without being completely on. Like, he's ready to handle fraught situations. Like, he hasn't done something like grossly stupid yet. Point the third, he is smarter than John Cena. You've seen John Cena try to make this transition. John Cena is ripped, and I'm sure that he is eating nearly as much lean protein as The Rock is every day, but he can't fucking pull it off.
So many raw eggs.
He was good in blockers. He was solid in blockers, but he's just not giving you the consistency or charm. I will fucking go toe-to-toe with you. He was not the best part of blockers, but I fucking love blockers. Would you rather watch John Cena on a talk show or Dwayne The Rock Johnson? He's one of our current great talk show guests. Point the fourth, he is never going to make shitty Oscar bait. There are always these people who become like semi-successful at comedy and then try to do something respectable. He never will. He may run for public office as a Republican, and that's probably more for Margaret to mention. But I would like to wrap up. My conclusion is he is a powerful force to keep mid-budget comedies alive. We live in a world where, you know, we have indie movies and we have movies with superheroes or robots that make $1 billion. And the in-between territory, it doesn't exist very much. I'm hopeful that Amazon and Netflix will make films like that. But this guy carried something like Central Intelligence, which was a fun, smart action comedy, and made it happen. And I fundamentally believe in Dwayne The Rock Johnson. All right. I cede the floor to you, Ms. Advocate.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments, Guy. I'd like to now come in with the counter argument. I need a gavel to be struck right now.
Gavel.
Yes, thank you. So my biggest objection to crowning The Rock is that I think we're already too late. Okay. He has decided to give the populace what they want. He is delivering. They are happy. But I would say that we're going to look back a few years from now and see this as this is the top for The Rock, and he's going to start sliding down. He's now making, $20 million plus per picture, and that's great. But he is an action star, and he's 45 years old. And so he's got maybe 5 years left in him, and that's about it. Then he's going to have to...
I think you're ignoring recent advances in human growth hormone, okay?
like Tom Cruise.
I don't mean to be ageist. Yes. I mean, he can move on to many, many other glorious things, but is he going to still be holding buildings with his bare hands to stop them from falling on people of California? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think he will be replaced by a younger, more vital Rock person. And so therefore, what is he going to do? He's so obsessed with staying in his lane, which is this whole kind of mid-comedy thing. He's literally said, I want the audience to leave happy from every single one of my movies. He doesn't ever want to rock the boat, which is kind of boring. I want this man to give me a ridiculous Oscar bait grabbing role where he plays a dad who's flawed, and then his wife dies, the one that's capable, and he's left to take care of the quadriplegic son by himself. I want that kind of role, if only to just snicker a little bit to myself. And he's not willing to give it to us. He's just going to stay the course. He's just going to be the rock until he just crumbles into pieces. The fact that he's looking at the office of presidency is almost sole reason enough to block him from getting our seal of approval, because he has no ideas. Okay? No ideas. This Rolling Stone reporter asked him, okay, gun violence, you're really thinking about shootings in schools because the one that happened in Florida recently was like a half an hour from his own daughter's school. What's your ideas? What are we going to do about this? And he said, I don't know, but we got to keep the children safe. Thank you, The Rock. This is astounding political thinking. Can't wait to see you in office. Like, he just doesn't have anything there. There's no there. I mean, at least John Cena tried to make, like, some kind of video where he was walking around talking about treating ladies nice or something like that. I mean, The Rock just cuddles with his daughter on Instagram, which is great. And I think the reason we're even thinking about him as any kind of presidential material is because we're so lost right now in the Trump woods, and because we're all still obsessed with daddy coming and saving us.
Uh-huh.
And he's kind of big daddy. He's like big, muscular daddy, and he can come and swoop you up from the storms. But I don't want the patriarchy save anymore. I want something else. I don't want The Rock to save me. I want something else entirely. And I just cannot give this man my seal of approval, because he is just boring, and he's going to stay the same until he just gets kind of replaced out.
All right. Sarah Gertrude, Karen, we open the floor to you. You can ask us questions. You can make points of your own.
Well, I want to answer to Margaret's point about The Rock aging out of action.
Yeah.
And these are, it's related to like my one primary pro inclination towards The Rock, and that's, this man is a Pacific Islander.
Yes.
That gives him an added 10 to 15 years of being hot shit action and looking way younger than everybody else. Mm-hmm. So we've got to give that up to The Rock, because, you know, he's not going to prove
also medical
age.
Science.
Yes, medical science. But, you know, he is from the islands. Moana, of course, being one of, I mean, the point about Moana, though, is that it's not necessarily The Rock himself. It's The Rock's voice, right?
And yeah.
This cool, right. Like, animated figure. I guess my only pro really is that he's a Pacific Islander. Because fundamentally, the thing that, you know, I have a long memory, like an elephant, and I will never forget that The Rock stood on the floor of the 2000 Republican National Convention, the convention where George W. Bush was nominated and was there to help get out the vote and to pump
yep.
up and drive up the Republican vote. And even though now he declares he's an independent.
But, like, what does that even mean right
yeah,
now?
What does
he's
that
not
even,
willing to really say what that means.
You know, it just means that, you know, he's trying to hit, like, the broadest possible demographic. It's just
yes.
like, hey, I'm not going to say anything controversial. As you were saying, it links to that boring aspect. Do we have a clip from the RNC?
You invited The Rock, the World Wrestling Federation champion, to speak at the Republican National Convention? Well, The Rock says this. What's the matter with you people? If The Rock didn't know any better, he'd say you might be trying to reach out to all The Rock's fans, the 14 million eligible voters who watch The Rock every single week.
Damning. That's really damning. I mean, it's hard to come back from that.
Yeah. I mean, that's really all I have to say. Once you support Bush, once you are there to drive up the vote, and once you are there to ensure that Al Gore does not become our president in 2000, I don't know. I just can't yeah. forgive you, man.
Seth, I would say, I just want to open by saying that unprovoked, I watch Ballers
uh-huh.
in
oh, wow.
my free time,
really?
Of which I have none.
It's good?
No.
I watch Ballers too.
It's terrible. But I like the guys, I like watching men do things. I don't do that a lot, so it's, like, very interesting to me. But I will say that I feel like it is a pure song of his soul. Mm-hmm. I really think mm-hmm. it is his world, and mm-hmm. I think he has crafted it. And the women in that show are unforgivably written. And while I will say in the pro column, when he came out, do you remember his tweet about, like, pro giving head? This was mm-hmm. when DJ Khaled was talking about how gross it was.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a shining moment for him.
Yes.
It really
yeah.
stood out. But I really have to say, just looking at sort of this window into his soul that is Ballers, I cannot forgive him. The female characters in that show are so underdeveloped. There are literally just like mommy wives and whores.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but I will present one last piece of evidence from also the Rolling Stone profile. He is in a restaurant where he is a regular, and he comes in with food from another restaurant. He asks the waiter to have the chef reheat the food from the other restaurant.
Whoa.
And the waiter says, and he says, no, he'll do it. And then he gives the waiter the food and it's done. But I, as a former service industry person, can hardly look past this gross abuse of your regular customer privileges.
Margaret,
at a
you have
restaurant.
To respect the amount of cod he has to eat in a day. He has to eat 3 pounds of cod every day.
He probably does have some very specific dietary needs, but I feel like that is like so gross.
That's when the
reporter
ghost
is there. Well, that's in front
also
of a reporter.
You did that in front of a reporter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What do you do in real life?
Yeah. You are a moron.
But that's also when the ghost of Jonathan Gold comes descending from this radiant cloud and says, "Hell nah."
No.
Sarah, do you want to call the previous question?
Oh, I don't know. Tell me what to do.
Say, I call
the previous question.
All right. The previous question has been called. Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, you are not allowed to vote, but if you
thank
were...
Thank you. Thanks for reminding me. I forgot. I thought I had power.
Just like a woman 150 years ago, okay?
If you were going to vote, would you vote yes or no?
Fuck no!
All right. Karen Tongson.
It's coming down to Karen, really.
It's the real vote.
I'm sorry to betray a person from the Pacific Islands, but I have to say no.
All right.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Karen Tongson has voted a no. That is a functional veto in this situation. The motion cannot move forward, but we will still go through and get the remainder of the vote. Margaret Wappler, you now release your obligations as the Cinema Snobs advocate. You are now acting only in your own capacity. Do you vote yes or no?
The Rock, I like you pretty well. I'll probably go see your next movie. I like that you cuddle with your daughter on Instagram. I think you're a good model of masculinity. At the same time, I cannot allow you in good conscience to have our seal of approval, especially
our first
the first
seal.
One.
Yeah.
That's fair. Margaret, I have to say, you raised a lot of really good points. The idea of he is too much staying on his lane, I found fascinating. Also, after you mentioned it, all I wanted to think about was dialogue from the movie where his wife dies and he has a paraplegic child.
Right? Don't deny us that thing, Rock.
I assumed some line about, if only I could give you my quads. I will fruitlessly, but fruitfully, vote yes, and we will say the motion has failed, but the segment lives on. I encourage
We will find another worthy person to debate.
Yeah. I think if you guys try really hard, there might be somebody out there.
I think we were delirious when we began with The Rock. As
I feel like it actually
movie.
was good fodder for debate.
Yeah.
Oh, also, we did that instead of All Abouts. I hope you liked our stupid parliamentary procedure game. It was very fun. Hey, Rocketeers, if you've got someone you think should be considered for the Pop Rocket Seal of Approval, you tell us who it is. We'll consider it and probably vote it down because it's pretty special. All right, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about who is America and how the power of television can be used for good and evil.
And rolling. The news today is terrible, so why not forget about it while listening to Jonah Radio with Cash Hartzell.
Hey, everybody.
Featuring Neil Mahoney.
Also me.
This is a podcast where we play music submitted by a listener. We hang out, we listen to new tunes, and we take submissions at jonahradio, R-A-Y-D-I-O, at gmail.com. Come and check us out. We're here anyway.
Yeah, we'll be here.
So, and that's it. Back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
And Sacha Baron Cohen has returned to the small screen with Who is America? A Showtime show that is not unlike his earlier work on The Ali G Show from the early aughts. Like on The Ali G Show, Cohen interviews people in character and gets them to humiliate themselves for our viewing pleasure. Do you guys like this?
That's a really broad question, Guy. I feel like before the show started, actually, Sarah was expressing some opinions about...
Which I'm happy to do again. I have no problem.
Yeah, but you know, like, but about like, yeah, you know, maybe a kind of gendered experience around watching the show.
I did. What I was actually telling Karen is, like, in preparation for coming here today, I try to do homework when I, you know, when I get an assignment, I usually do it. I tried really hard to watch it, and I could not physically stand to watch it. And it was so uncomfortable for me that I ended up asking my cis male life partner to watch it for me and tell me what happened. And he put on headphones and started guffawing and decided that he was a fucking genius. And the thing that occurred to me, so I even Googled like other podcasts where they've talked about it. The only one I found was a guy who does a podcast on his drive to work every day. It's like an 8-minute drive. And he said that his wife couldn't watch it because it made her so uncomfortable. And so what I started to think about was being socialized female and the way that we are made to do anything possible to make people comfortable in our presence.
Well, I think boys like pranks and girls like saying mean things about other their friends. And I define myself as a girl for these purposes.
Yeah.
And I think that Unreal is actually a really interesting sort of like counterposition of like both reality television and like what Sacha Baron Cohen does are sort of about creating these cringeworthy moments, but his is in such a like stylized, distanced, like somebody, he always positions himself above the situation.
Yeah.
And in something like The Bachelor or a show like Unreal, we're all complicit and yeah, we all understand that.
Yeah. And I also think coercion and entrapment are sort of fundamentally incorrect. I think he is so useful. I think there are a couple things in Borat, like the rodeo scene in Borat, where the crowd starts chanting, like, bomb them all to death, kill every woman and child in Iran or in Iraq. I feel like that was revelatory because he actually got them to express something that they felt. But when he's putting words in people's mouths and putting them in situations they would never put themselves in, I don't think it's smart.
I hate dinner parties where he, like, people are just being polite. Like, he is like,
yeah,
haha, be racist. And then they're like, what do you need, strange foreign person? Margaret.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to it?
I have to admit, this is super interesting, and I totally understand where you guys are coming from, and I have the same kind of cringe feelings when I'm watching him, but I've always been an admirer of his shtick, his work. I think one of the most revelatory things about Sacha Baron Cohen that I've heard lately is that he studied at clowning school. And I feel like ultimately his whole thing is about just like exposing all discourse and political rhetoric as like a hall of mirrors, where like in some ways that moment between his kind of ultra like Reed College professor NPR shirt wearing guy thing where he goes and has dinner with the Trump.
That was the one I could watch.
Yeah, with South the Trump Carolina. People mm-hmm. in South Carolina. I thought that was so interesting because I felt like he was sort of mirroring back to them what their worst idea of what like liberal, crazy, like libtards are, you know, like he has this whole joke about like making his little girl pee standing up.
In
his
on a
little,
camera.
Yeah. And his little boy pee standing down just so that their like gender roles are totally broken down. And it's like, of course, an absurd, borderline abusive concept. And like they're just listening to him and being polite. And there's another thing that it reveals about politeness and how much we've kind of let a lot of things, all of us do, we let a lot of things slide in our daily lives under the guise of being polite, that we don't want to say to people, actually, that's a racist joke or that's a sexist notion or whatever, because we just want to keep the peace. And sometimes you can say it's about no judgment, but clearly they were judging him. They just didn't really want to like get in the ring and like grapple with him. And actually, I found those people very likable.
That's what I thought was the most interesting.
Yeah. And I appreciated that because at this particular moment in time, I'm so up in arms against Trump voters. Like, I'm so angry about it. And it was actually like a comforting, strange relief to see these two people that I found much more likable than his sort of libtard character. Mm-hmm. And I think there's just something very interesting he's doing about exposing like the ways in which we talk to each other from opposite sides of the fence, supposedly, the things that we are willing to sort of admit and reveal. I actually don't think most of the time that he puts words in people's mouths. I think he sets up a situation that makes them feel pressured to do it. And like that is if anything, talking or making a commentary about how much pressure people can feel when the cameras are on them. And I think that's actually worthy to talk about, too, in American life, like how much people are willing to say and push themselves rhetorically when they think a camera is on them and they have to take a position. I mean, this Joe Walsh, that I think is one of his most successful skits in the whole thing is when he gets all these gun advocates playing his sort of Israeli far right anti-terrorist guy. He gets all these various gun advocates to say
Republican congresspeople.
Yeah, crazy, like, you know, yes, put guns in the hands of 3-year-olds. And Joe Walsh has been like, oh, he tricked me into saying that. It's like, Joe Walsh, you were there giving your talking head advocacy of this program 100%.
I would say, because I did watch the beginning of that segment, one of the things that I thought was the most stunning and truly revelatory and really good work and really interesting was something that Philip Van Cleef said out of his very own mouth, unprovoked, which is he actually volunteered, if they haven't developed consciousness of children haven't developed consciousness of right and wrong, they can be very fine soldiers.
Yes.
That was chilling. And that, yeah, and that's the kind of stuff at his finest that I think he's incredible at. And I just feel that it worries.
It hurts to see.
The thing is that I think that this style of comedy has contributed to kind of a bad evolution in politics, in that sort of it's just this frat boy scoffing at people who try or purport to be like right about things. And like, ooh, look, I caught them with their pants down. And there are a lot of politicians who are just comfortable having their pants down now. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's like for every politician who turns around and says, well, he caught me, like, there are also going to be ones who say, yeah, we should put guns in 3-year-olds like hands and just say that that's a viable position now.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, though, that one of the things, though, that is fundamentally telling, one of the moments that was fundamentally telling, it's in that segment with Dr. Neera Kane and Ndege Ocello, the cis male white heterosexual gender studies lecturer at Reed College, and the Trump supporting couple in South Carolina, is that the one point of connection that they all sincerely had to do with the Herman Miller chairs. So it was like this fundamental, it's like, oh, Herman Miller chairs. Oh, yes, we like. So there is still this kind of sense of fundamentally of bourgeois privilege and an understanding that cuts across all of the porpoise infidelity and, you know, children being broken, their children's genders being broken by being standing up or sitting down inappropriately. And when it all boils down to it, they can find refuge or comfort, at least the people, you know, who don't realize that this is a made-up character.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yes, but we also love Herman Miller chairs.
Did you guys see the epilogue? Because I was able to watch that. It's a couple. They some interviewer asked that couple.
Yeah, yeah.
They say, how would you describe his views? And the man's like, I don't want to be rude, but frankly, fucked up. Yeah. It was great. I thought it was wonderful they included that segment because it actually made, you know what I mean? It was like, it made the couple look better than,
Like, which is interesting because he's then essentially just doing like a clown, like a clown version of a liberal for an audience that isn't entirely aware of what they're doing. The comedy all came from him. The segment I found most fascinating was him talking to the Laguna Beach art dealer.
Oh, yeah.
Because, oh, yeah.
So the character he's playing is a former prisoner who now is an artist, but his media, it was the only things that he had in prison, which were his own bodily fluids. So you have him playing this weird sort of like sexual contact game with a woman, essentially, of like at one moment he leaves and comes back and hands her a portrait of her, and he definitely implies that he used some of his semen to make it. And the thing is she meets him beat for beat at every moment.
Oh, yes.
She never gives him, because that really is just sort of the worst kind of like boy trying to put his booger on a girl kind of comedy. And she's just like, you know, you really are a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't tell how aware of what was going on she was. I just loved that she did not give him the satisfaction of that, frankly, like, misogynistic brutalism game.
But
brutality
I think,
game.
I think that's, again, linked, though, to my Herman Miller chair's comment, where it's just, like, it's also about commerce. It's also about, like, money, right? So she's a gallerist.
Yeah.
She wants to not alienate a potential client.
Also, she's on camera.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yes, of course. I'm like, this is true. Yes,
like,
she's
I actually,
on camera.
That was, like, one of those situations where I felt so bad for her, because I'm like, she's a freaking Laguna Beach art dealer. What the hell is that? First of all, what does that mean?
It's a lot of dolphin art.
Exactly. She sells watercolors of the beach.
Okay. So I'm like, really, if they were trying to challenge themselves, I'm like, find a real gallery. Like, she's low-hanging fruit.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And also,
he's all about low-hanging fruit.
I don't appreciate that. I don't admire it. I think that she was such low-hanging fruit, and she had a freaking camera on her. And what was the last time a camera was in that gallery? And God knows what they said to her about who they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just feel like it's very exploitative. But I think at the end of the day, if we all think about what we walked away with, I mean, I think it's, like, incredibly useful, right? That, like, everybody now knows that, yes, our politicians are that fucking crazy that they literally want to put guns in babies' hands. I mean, I think that's very useful, but I feel like the cruelty and proving that, like, he is funnier and better than these people that are, like, Laguna Beach art dealers
is useless. It's
to me.
Just so smug and bloodless. There's nothing of him in there.
Yeah.
He's never presenting a real view. It's always a caricature for someone to react to. And there's just, like, a degree to which his comedy always goes back to this mid-2000s homophobia, essentially.
That's really interesting. Yes.
Really bothers me. Like, in the second episode, he has this truly horrible Georgia
state assembly member or something.
Yeah, he was
like
state congressman.
And like he has this guy, you know, he gets him to say racial slurs and he has him put stuff up his butt and stuff like that, but it's just a whole lot of I made this guy do a gay thing. Isn't that gross? And I kind of hate Sacha Baron Cohen. I just hate his sort of like he's like smug and wants to act above things without ever actually saying anything or making a point.
Well, I think you made like a brilliant point, which is that he is masked. He's not vulnerable. Like, yeah. there's no part of himself that's at risk in any way.
Well, and I do think it is at least riskier than like The Daily Show, which I think very much is the same kind of like smug scoffing without a perspective. He's at least physically there, but it just feels kind of bloodless when you compare it to something like, say, Nanette.
Yes. Which is rather vulnerable.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, you know, I think that I'm more ambivalent than either of you are about the show.
I actually don't hate it. Weirdly, I don't hate it. I'm actually glad it exists.
Yeah.
I just
had a very strong reaction to it as a person who has fought against, like, manipulation. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, as someone who is actually rather ambivalent about the show and is also appreciative of the things it unearths in these scenarios where there's a camera, where people are forced to, you know, challenge their own notions of decorum, the thing that made me most uncomfortable was actually the segment with the one of the former cast-offs from The Bachelor, Corinne Olympios. Did you see that in the second episode?
Yeah.
Where essentially there is this kind of I suppose he's supposed to be Italian, Gio Monaldo, or whatever his name is, a billionaire who has a kind of lifestyle show and coerces her into appearing, you know, like inserting herself into, like, basically being green screened into a scene where she, you know, is a rescue worker in Sierra Leone and also advocating for, again, child soldiers. But you can see so much discomfort in her carriage, in the way she's talking. Vulture wrote a pretty great piece about this.
Yeah, they said she was shaking and looking for her manager.
I think that it would, it was really awkward because the whole point of that segment was to show how thirsty these reality stars are, how much they're willing to kind of sell themselves and their souls to, you know, be spokespeople for anything. But it struck me as a little bit really kind of profoundly awkward at minimum, and I don't know, really uncomfortable at best, at its worst.
And incredibly sexist.
Why is it sexist
when she was the one who, like, voluntarily made a commercial?
I think it's a little Me Too-y in a way where there's this, like, rich, older white guy who is, you know, kind of charming, who flouts his power, he flouts his money, he's, you know, he's really kind of framing the situation as all having to do with upping, you know, like, I find that there's something kind of fundamentally coercive about that exchange. And I don't know if it's like just that I'm, you know, hypersensitive to these dynamics, but I do think that that was in play where, you know, she's young, she's somewhat naive. And I think that the sense that he was a billionaire, like, really sealed the deal.
I mean, she made up a story about meeting a despotic world leader on the spot. I mean, this is that's going above and beyond just like, okay, I'll repeat some copy you told me to say. I mean, she lied. Like, she knew, she's old enough to understand lying.
I would say this, though, like the big picture for me is that we create these monsters and then we mock them for being monsters. Uh-huh. I mean, we made her.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like 16 million people tuned in to watch The Bachelor while she was on it. So now she's addicted to being on camera. And now we're mocking her for being addicted to being on camera. Like,
but nobody gets forced to be on camera. Nobody gets forced to be a reality TV star. Like, there are people that get that life and then turn away from it. Like,
there are. But I would say like a fundamental tenet of what I was doing on Unreal was actually just about that, like the concept that you're like, they know what they were signing up for. And truly, like, these women are huge victims of the patriarchy. Like,
yeah,
they suck. Like, I hated working with those people. I absolutely think they suck. But we made them.
Yeah.
So I feel like we have some responsibility.
Well, I would agree with you maybe 10 or 15 years ago, but I kind of feel like at this point now, like, everyone knows what the reality TV sort of like script and bargains are, you know, like the sort of social contract of being a reality TV star. And like, she's willing to sort of like take as much positive publicity and branding opportunities and all the rest of it. And the minute she gets kind of busted because she repeated stories that this man told her, she's going to be upset. I don't know. It's also sort of like, powerful lesson learned. That's okay. I mean, she learned a lesson.
I do think there's something very interesting to the idea of he gets these people into non-adversarial situations so frequently. Like, you know, the adversarial situation of the liberal caricature with the conservative couple sort of doesn't get you much from them and gets him doing comedy for its own sake.
Yeah.
But like, when he gets these people that they're not adversarial, that they are just sort of like cooperating with someone, does lead them down this path. But the trouble is that, as you're saying, being led down that path is a viable industry both in politics and in entertainment. Right. And it pays off far more than it does, you know, becoming a problem. And, like, my fundamental problem is that he's saying, ugh, look at these people who thought that they have dignity. They have no dignity. And it's like, at this point in time in America, anyone who is willing to try a little bit to have dignity or belief in, like, philosophies other than their own advancement, we need to, like, pat them on the head like a child who's being potty trained.
But I don't think he's unaware of the criticisms that have always swirled around his whole shtick. I mean, ever since Barat, people have been like, you are putting people in the position to say things they wouldn't normally say.
Yeah.
You're not putting any of yourself on the line. You're being a caricature, you're being a character. I mean, all of those things, I think he's interested in starting the conversation. Mm-hmm. And there may be in some ways that is flawed as like, yeah, you're not putting yourself as Sasha on the line. You're being these different characters. You're not necessarily making any kind of stance. You're showing people in really unflattering lights. I mean, all of those things are true, but like, I kind of feel like that's almost what he's interested in talking about is like, who's at fault when you're sitting down to play Dr. Neela, whoever he is, you know, is it him who's saying actually the much more ludicrous, problematic things in that conversation? Or is it the Trump people who are kind of politely listening and, you know, not really contributing what they might do on their side?
I guess I would feel like it was so much smarter if he ever somehow addressed that. Like, if he wants to make a, you know, expose about politeness, like, let's talk about that. But it's like he's the only winner.
But I never see him as a winner, I guess. I never see those characters coming out ahead. Half the time, I think those characters sound just as stupid.
No, I'm saying Sasha Baron Cohen.
I mean, Sasha.
I mean,
himself.
He's always smirkingly above whatever perspective he's taking, which just feels like dishonest and not a great place to start.
And I would say, like, we're living in the post-apocalypse. Like, I think being that ungenerous is, like, not helpful. You know what I mean? Like, I sort of feel like we are so far the fuck around the bend right now that, like, having anti-humanity doesn't feel as interesting to me as having humanity.
Is there any... Sorry. None of his characters are as ridiculous as the person who is in charge of our country right now.
I know.
And I think that that, like, makes me annoyed with the whole thing a little bit more.
Although I will acknowledge your point, Margaret, though, that, that part of what this does is that it creates a space for the id to unleash itself.
Yes.
And to, you know...
It's all there, yeah, no matter whether Sasha's exploiting it or not. Yeah. It's
and
all
I think
there.
That one of the issues and one of the problems that, you know, sort of we dealt with, like, kind of pre-2016, post-2016, is the people being shocked that there were such ugly feelings, like, yeah, lurking beneath the forms of civility and kind of the Obama-era America. And part of what this show does is it like really, I guess, underscores more than amplifies the fact that at this point, you know, all bets are off and people are willing to say things explicitly and loudly.
Yeah.
And not just that's the part of it that leaves me ambivalent, is because it's almost like we don't need to do a gotcha, like dress in a disguise, rope people into some sort of you know, extreme scenario in
just
order to get them to say,
torch.
Yeah, hand them a tiki torch. You know, say it's like the scene where, again, that character, Dr. Ndegeocello, shows up and proposes to build a mosque in Kingman, Arizona.
Your town will become a hub for tourism for Muslims around the world. Can I get a whoop whoop?
No.
No.
We don't want that shit here.
You bring your Muslim, we might have problems. We'll have problems.
Yeah.
And the crowd becomes a mob and essentially very explicitly states, you know, it's like, you know, that we actually barely tolerate black people here. What do you think?
Yeah, that
you
was
know, why
yeah.
do you think
chilling.
We would accept a mosque? And I think across the board, not every segment is effective, but I think that it is in those moments where, again, it's an underscoring of that.
Like, that's incredibly valuable, yeah.
That I think, you know, we need to learn.
It is so interesting
from.
To see and to sort of scrape the veneer off. But, like, it's hard because so much of the veneer has already been scraped off.
I was going to say, like, even just decent reporting at this point, like, I think the woman who reported on the Charlottesville pre-protest from Vice. I don't remember the reporter's name, unfortunately, but I think she did such an excellent job. And what she really proved to me is that these people would love to tell you what they believe. They're just waiting for somebody to train a camera on them.
And it gives us, I feel like his smugness infects the whole thing where we get to watch those people and be like, those are the people who are wrong with America. And then other people get to watch him talk to Bernie Sanders and be like, ah, those are the people who are wrong with America. And it just lets everyone pat themselves on the back for not
Which
being
Which is the
ridiculous.
Fundamental problem. That we have right now is that everybody just wants to feel good about themselves.
Yeah.
Or feel like they're right.
Yes. Like there's,
yeah.
We're not really engaging so much anymore.
Yeah.
What would make the show more palatable for you guys? Like what about what he's doing? Like if he was still kind of pranking people, but there was something more vulnerable or something more.
I think Stephen Colbert in his Comedy Central form was the form of it that I liked because you still felt like there was a person there and there was an attempt he was using it to engage rather than sort of just like make a person be ridiculous. I'm sorry.
I think that's actually no, you didn't at all. You're in power. I have no power.
You have all, full power of debate. We let you move to the previous question, Sarah.
I go back to the corner. No, but I actually think Stephen Colbert is a great example. Like Stephen Colbert at the White House Correspondents' Dinner to me. The bravery of doing that bold-faced looking people in the eye as you are taking them to task.
Mm-hmm.
To me, like that bravery is outstanding and it's super inspiring. And I would say just like even with the Who Is America stuff, I would totally take it if it was just a little bit less coercion. Like I just don't need that level of setting people up.
Is it partially because of the costumes and the masks and whatever, which have gone up a big level
They've gone up a big level. But like I said, that one quote about, you know, children don't have conscience, so they make great soldiers. That came from inside that person without any coercion.
Right.
And that was incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm like, that's an incredible moment that he created.
Yeah.
So I feel like he's overdoing it basically. He's just going, he doesn't need to go that far. I think just basically setting people up in the situations without taking it that far would make it a lot more valid to me. And like people getting in their silos, like their Fox News versus everybody else and just wanting to be right is a huge problem. So I think like the segment with the couple at home who actually was shocked to hear that this guy was like basically torturing his children, that was helpful because I'm like just showing that like people still have humanity. We agree on like common values as Americans or whatever. There are a few things we still agree on.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that might sound really saccharine, but I feel like for where we are at, it is like really dangerous to just be
vulgar or cruel.
Although I do feel that I actually feel that the most effective segments are those that just, you know, barely tug on reality without pushing it too far, without like going to the extreme of talking about his wife having an affair with like a dolphin or something like that from Tulum, right? It's where, you know, someone sits down, I guess it's the Mossad anti-terror expert sits down with Dick Cheney and gets him to brag about, you know, his record on torture, essentially, and to autograph a waterboarding device. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where you're like, okay, we may have suspected that you had actually no soul and no humanity.
Now
you've utterly confirmed it, because what you've done is a kind of like just a shift in audience or perspective, the sense that you're in the sense that Dick Cheney felt that he was in a room with someone who understood him, mm-hmm. like just allowed that guard to drop mm-hmm. enough to give us, you know, to again confirm our worst fears or what it was that we imagined
It's valuable to see what people will say when they think that they're with somebody who's like-minded, you know, especially that particular ilk, you know, the somebody like Dick Cheney, who's obviously like highly media experienced and like knows how to control an interview. I mean, it was interesting to me who came off well in certain moments. Like, I was really happy that Ted Koppel actually, like
I can't pulled the...
Yeah, he was just like, you're ridiculous. Like, you can't even tell what midnight is and what it looks like on film, so I'm cutting off this interview. Yeah, there were times where it actually, like, as much as it horrified me, there were also times it gave me relief and kind of made me feel like, oh, there's still some hope. Like, there's still people that, like, stand their ground. There's still people, even, like, the Trump South Carolina people who are, like, actually seemed, like, pretty okay, you know? Like, even though I'm on the opposite side of the political spectrum from them, I feel like I could have a glass of wine with them and be all right. You know what I mean? And there's something, like, actually worthwhile to me about that. I don't think it's all, like, look at these assholes who voted for Trump. I do think there's, like, enough. I mean, even him, like, playing around with Bernie, you know, like, Bernie, I mean, he pretty much just, like, poked at the way that Bernie is so self-serious and cannot for, like, one second just playful and just, you know, like, work with somebody. Like, that, I just think there's something valuable in seeing those sides of people.
Bernie Sanders is never not saying percent.
Exactly. I know. Do you guys, it's a totally real question. Like, do you think any Trump voters will watch that show?
No.
That's a good question.
I think that they may see some segments. I think that they may see whatever segments are released and floated around social media. Yeah. But I don't know that there'll be a kind of active HBO subscriber base among them already.
I would say younger Trump voters, maybe, who like kind of just have an appetite.
Who are those people? Well, I don't know, but also
probably think it is hilarious when a bunch of guys say we should give guns to 3-year-olds, and they're like, "Fuck yeah, we should."
Yeah, I kind of think it's only going to rile them up. Like, I don't like that.
But so be it. Like, that's I mean, for me, I just feel like let's get all this dirty laundry out on the floor so we can sort it
and have a civil war.
Margaret wants civil war.
Get all this dirty laundry out and just fight it out in the street.
So let's pivot and talk about Unreal, because, of course, your fourth season is out. But you raised the question earlier, sort of like, who is responsible in these situations where you have somebody prodded to say something for the benefit of media. Like, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen is basically sort of like giving people enough rope to look ridiculous, but most of our good television is that now.
Yeah, I would say, like, for Unreal, you know, Unreal is based on a short film that I wrote and directed, and a really, like, fundamental tenet of that film was that you needed to have equal compassion for the producer and the contestant, because the film is basically I lifted and put into the pilot of Unreal, so it's the scene where, like, the producer breaks down the contestant at the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a storytelling perspective, for me, just as a writer, that was really important, because it's super boring to have it be one-sided. But actually, like, fundamentally as a piece of work in my decision process to make it and spend, like, 9 years of my life, like, doing this thing, I felt like what was really important was to have compassion for the people that we've created. And so there are a couple things in the pilot of Unreal, like Quinn, who's the executive producer, played by Constance Zimmer, goes on sort of a racist rant about how there are no black wifeys and the first girl out of basically the limo can't be a black girl and blah, 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 blah. And everyone's looking at her, giving her shade. And she goes, what? It's not my fault America's racist. And, like, that is sort of the thesis of the show, is, like, it is actually fundamentally her fault. She's one of the few people in charge of reality television. Mm-hmm. And she's, like, upholding those narratives. So it's, like, so I think what I feel is that people do have a lot of culpability when they go looking for their 15 seconds or 15 minutes of fame. I would say I totally agree with Margaret that at this point in time, they pretty much know what they're getting into. There's, you know, the information is available. People have written tell-all books. Like, you can find out what you're getting into. But I would say people having that insatiable desire to be documented is kind of our fault.
What is, like, what would you say is the power relationship between, like, you have somebody who's on camera, it's their goddamn mouth, but then you have somebody who is, like, savvy and understands the game and understands the tropes and understands how editing work. Do you feel like fundamentally there is a power disparity between an adult person on a reality show and a producer, or no?
1,000% yes. I would say that it's an unbeatable chess game, because you basically have, like, an entire army of people working to turn you into a character, and you don't have control of who that character is going to be. Mm-hmm. You also cannot withstand, like, the power of editing and writing and story and narrative. I mean, like, it's a total... I think that a lot of people foolishly feel like they can outsmart the game, and it's just totally unbeatable. Mm-hmm. Because when I was doing it, at least... we were still in the era where we really didn't hand people, like, pieces of paper with words on them. Like, we did not break standards and practices. I have no idea what they're doing now. But we actually got trained, like, in the skill of asking questions in such a way that the syntax of the reply would work correctly in, like, an audio bed.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And, like, even, like, knowing how to ask questions where people would just say no, because as you're editing in your head while you're speaking to them, you know you're going to need a no.
Yeah.
So it's like... you're a gargoyle. No, I'm not. And so you're like, thank you. I mean, and so, like, also just learning, like, the fundamental tenet of like, stupidest question gets the best answer. Like, you hate puppies. Like, you obviously are, like, vilely, like, have so much hatred towards puppies. No, I don't. No, I don't. I never said that, is, like, a very useful soundbite. Uh-huh. So my basic answer is, I think people... you know, think they know what they're getting into, and it's really easy to blame them, but ultimately it's a pretty unbeatable game.
It's interesting to hear you say that about the moment with Quinn saying it's not my fault that America is racist, because I always thought that, like, the ambiguity of the fact that you have these two women who are fighting to establish, they have such middle management power. Yeah. Like, they really are trying to satisfy, like, a patriarchal machine that is always... saying, well, if you do it right, we'll give you real power, but then never actually
never
doing
it.
Yeah, and I...
it's like, and it's an unbeatable game for them. That's the whole point.
Well, and I feel like it's it's such an interesting, like, such an interesting portrayal of women in a power position where, like, you have all the subtlety and nuance and psychology of being able to see things for what they are and, like, reflect based reality, but, like, not having a feeling that they can, like, guide or shape it or make a big call about it.
But that's why I really appreciated one of the earliest scenes of the first episode of this last season, where they're essentially in the control room and they have this exchange.
I love it. It's so dark. It's so demented. It's like, I'm scared. I'm disgusted. I'm turned on. What do I do?
I guess the hair is not the only thing that's new.
And you have nothing. Not even a trace of feminist guilt. Nowhere.
I just got tired of hearing myself talk. You know, I thought a lot about what you said. It's the reason I came back here. I don't know. I'm all in, Quinn. I am everlasting.
Yeah, I mean, the getting tired of hearing myself talk. I love that. I think that, you know, that's it's sort of a commentary. It's an interesting commentary on a kind of where white feminist womanhood is at this particular moment of you know, that having everyone else say, we're tired of hearing you talk, and finally having that acknowledged through kind of Rachel's expression and seeing her unravel around that, you know, acknowledgement is really striking to me.
Yeah, it was what this season was about for me. You know, there was a possibility that the series was going to end at the end of season three, so I sort of wrote an ending for the series at the end of season three.
And that was a very nice and tidy ending.
Yes, that was the one that was like, my ending. Like, she runs away to Oregon and gets a cabin or whatever. but then we found out we were coming back, which was cool, and it was, like, great to have another season. And I really thought about, like, what do you do when you've hit every wall of the fishbowl? Like, you've tried booking everything. And like, to your point, exactly, Guy, like they are in an unbeatable game with the patriarchy, mm-hmm. which is like, no matter what they do, no matter how high they fly, there will always be a guy above them.
Yeah.
Like no matter what. So like, she's not going to win.
So you got to keep digging those graves for the ones in the oven, you know?
Right, exactly. And like, she's like, I'll just win at the other game. Like, I'll get a fucking ring on it by the end of the season. I'm going to get my ass married. And I can do this. And who says I'm gross? I'm not a troll. I'm a fucking troll with highlights.
And eyelashes.
Eyelashes. She's really into her eyelashes. So that was, yeah, conceptually to me, like, I think that what Karen is hitting on is, like, everybody's gotten tired of hearing her talk. Mm-hmm. And so now where does she go now? And I think it's, for me, it's very Trumpian, too. Like, it started as an Obama-era show, and it's ending as a Trump-era show.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was so great always trying to decide who was more evil, so to speak, like Quinn or Rachel. Like, I think when the show started, there was this sense that Quinn was like the ultimate operative and that she was the dark one and didn't care about any of these women's lives. And then you see that Rachel is like the little foot soldier, actually can make some bigger, darker moves. And in a way, like, felt like she always had the freedom to leave, or like Quinn was so deeply embedded that she just didn't. Like, how did you go about playing with bouncing those two back and forth?
That was like such an important sort of tenet of the show for me, was that actually at the end of the day, Quinn is a more ethical person because she's living by her own standards and she's willing to admit what she's doing. And that really the show was about like white liberal guilt and white liberal feminism and sort of self-aggrandizing, and that you're fucking delusional. You're making The Bachelor.
Right, like, right.
Everlasting.
I mean Everlasting, but that her tattered This Is What a Feminist Looks Like shirt, she's just clinging with everything she has to her college ideals. But I think it's really talking about the, you know, like spiritual bankruptcy of like a country and a situation where you spend 4 years in college becoming like the most idealistic you could ever be, and it totally doesn't apply to the real world. Like, we're living in a panopticon where like everybody's documenting themselves all the time and like doesn't give a fuck about anything, and the president's a reality star.
Like reality TV, like in this sort of like era of Obama hope, like still reality TV, which is all about realpolitik, which is really about like, at the, you didn't come to make friends, you came to win.
Yeah.
And it, like, it is so interesting that we fell in love with this thing where, you know, you out the trans guy so that you can maybe survive this tribal council. Like, that's what we hunger for and watch. But also, we like to pretend that we are
outraged.
Yes, yes. Okay, let's talk about that dynamic of watching these horrible things.
We just talked about being outraged over Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah.
Or some of us did.
Yes.
Who's American.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But, like, I just think it's weird that, like, we hunger for that certainty of rightness.
I know, but I think it's just the utter and complete impotence of that outrage.
Uh-huh.
It is so fucking useless. Like, I'm like, liberal outrage is so fucking useless at this point. I'm like, we need action, we need assholes, we need offense. Like, I am so fucking tired of being mad. Like, I want to have an effective strategy and I would like to employ it.
All right, now let's pivot to the most boring question that you get asked all the time, I'm sure. Just the fact that, like, women in, like, not just television, but, like, media, literature maybe, don't get to be assholes and don't get to like get shit done. There is a higher sort of like threshold for, oh, isn't that a nice person? And everyone, when they talk about, like when we talked on the show about Unreal, we talked about the idea of female anti-heroes, and like, it's hard at a time when we are trying to re-embrace idealism to also sort of embrace the idea that women get to do what it takes to get shit done.
Yeah, that's really complicated. What was the question?
The question.
I'm like, that's my whole life.
The question is, did you go into the show trying, like,
as me as a showrunner, as a creator?
As a creator, like, did you go into the show trying to represent a different kind of woman?
Yes. Didn't work. I tried.
And like,
is that why we get Rachel's highlights?
What is the assholedom you dream of?
I am a motherfucker. I'm super arrogant. Like, I have, like, a shitload of swagger. I'm not kidding when I say I have big dick energy. I'm also like, and Karen can attest, I'm actually like a kind, nice person. But because I actually like have worked in like the most aggressively male environments, like I worked in advertising and like sports advertising, like I have been around like the most obscene shit and I have zero tolerance for it. And I do not give a fuck if anybody likes me in my mind, right? Mm-hmm. I don't give a fuck if anybody likes me. I just have to get it done. And what I've really found is like not only the emotional toll and the physical toll of the extra work that's put upon us, mm-hmm. of like giving a shit, doing the emotional labor, like taking care of people, all that stuff I have a huge problem with. So I came in pretty strong just being like, look, this is my deal. This is what I want to do. And like, this is my vision. And it was really interesting because Sam Esmail, who created Mr. Robot, like mm-hmm. it was all happening for us at the same time. And yeah. his office was actually next to mine on the lot. And so I got to see how he was treated and I got to see how I was treated. And it was like when I walked out into the parking lot and saw that they had, I think they bought him a Tesla with a personalized license plate. And I was walking to the far, far parking garage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And Sam and I have talked about, I mean, like, it's pretty, I mean, it's not, we're not the same shows. I'm not, like, it's not a one for one, but we're pretty apropos.
I'm pretty sure that's because men are great geniuses and women at best can be, like, autobiographers.
Good helpers.
Good helpers, yeah.
Yeah. And there was a lot with me, too. Like, it was really hard because, like, I went to Sarah Lawrence for fiction writing. Like, I'm a writer. I've been a writer forever. I'm a filmmaker, you know? And it was so easy for people to be like, this chick who worked on The Bachelor. Mm-hmm. So, like, I fought that narrative a lot. And I think that, like, ultimately, I'm super proud of the show. I love the actors. I love what we did together. Like, it was great. But I got sat down and in a lot of trouble and told that I took up too much space.
Oy.
On a show that I created.
That's insane.
And I just, as I was sitting there like a little girl on a couch far below the person speaking to me who happened to be a dude, I just imagined like Sam sitting on that couch.
Or the drug addicts who we all deal with so that because they're great geniuses.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't actually advocate being a dick. Like, I think it's like running a show with like 200 to 300 people working really, really hard. It's actually important to take care of people. So I don't mean to say I think it's important to be an asshole. I think it's important to be unencumbered.
Uh-huh.
And you need to be able to do your job.
Yeah. And to feel like you deserve the things that should be coming to you.
But not, I mean, actually just to functionally do your job. That's what I really found, that like a lot of the time it feels like running with cement shoes on. Mm-hmm. Because while you're trying to be like, yeah, fuck, I'm super focused. I got this. Like, I'm totally fucking charging. They're like, can you just be really nice for a second and like come talk to everybody and make them feel better? And it's like, I could, but it would stop what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I think for me, I mean, I think there's a beautiful part of like entitlement and all that stuff. But I actually am just talking about functionally doing the job. It's super challenging if people refuse to see you as a voice. And I think it's pretty challenging for people to see a woman, especially a young woman, like when I sold the show as like the voice. And I'm friends with Sarah Treem, who created The Affair. I think she can totally speak for herself, but I feel like watching her career, she's had to navigate some of the same things. And we're all doing it, which is cool. But yeah, it just makes it harder to do the job. And I'm really into doing the job.
Yeah. Well, this is a different question than what you're talking about, but I just wondered, as a person creating satire and knowing how far you can push the line, was there ever a time where you felt like you either pushed the line too far or you were like, that's going too far and I'm not going to take the story in that direction?
Fuck yes. I think we like hit up against so many, like, I think we had missteps, big missteps. I think we pushed things too far. There were a couple things that I wish we had gone farther on. I think that our second season was super controversial and it was a big lesson for me. And like, I came in from the first season having fought for every word and been like pretty in charge of the creative. I mean, not like totally, but I had that season mapped out when I pitched the show and I fought for every single word and I slept at work and I was in the edit and I was like picked every song. We didn't have a music supervisor. Like, I was just I went to the color sessions. Like, I was all over it. And so I went into second season sort of assuming that was going to be my role again. And the show started getting some attention. And so actually they brought in a bunch of people and a lot of power was taken away from me. And I didn't put pen to paper after the second episode of the second season. And so I had pitched this really problematic and bold idea, whatever, of like having the first African-American suitor, which maybe would have been okay if I actually had that level of control.
Yeah.
It was super scary and crazy to do it
without control.
Yeah. And so there were storylines that we had, like when I pitched that idea, that just went away. And there were things, you know, I directed an episode where the main character's cousin gets shot and the end of the episode was scripted to be, and it was written by like the one, or I guess there were two women of color that season on staff, but a writer that I love, we were up on set together and the end of that episode ended with the cousin and the suitor in the hospital, and the story was really about them. Like, it ended on them. And I got told, like, 7 times probably that I had to cut the scene for budgetary reasons, and I was being told this from, like, an older white male producer who was just hammering on me about it. And because I was directing the episode, I tried anything I could do to solve it. I said, I'll shoot it in the corner. I don't even need a set. Like, I can do it from up above. It'll be like a hospital bed. I just need a pillow. All I need is a pillow. I was like, I'll jam through 3 scenes faster. Like, I found every way that it wouldn't cost him a dime. And he actually called the studio and said, if you bring it up one more time, we're going to remove you from set. And so that episode got absolutely clobbered for good reason. The entire point of the episode was that it was like white liberal bullshit. It wasn't her story to tell. And not only that, like, so it didn't have the ending it needed to have, but when they broadcast it live, they had done an interview with me about directing the episode. And they, right after the shooting, smashed me sitting talking head bragging about a camera shot I had designed. So that was really painful. So it was like, it was like a very good lesson to like make, like, my next project is about ISIS, and like, I'm probably not going to go forward with it unless I feel like I have really, really strong creative control, because I just can't do it again.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
This is a great liberal town, and all of our opinions are correct.
That's right.
That's great. We're going to be back to talk about our jams right after this.
How's it going, everyone? I'm Oliver Wang.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. We have a brand new show on the Maximum Fun Network that we'd love to share with you. It's called Heat Rocks.
Morgan, we should probably explain what a heat rock is.
It is a banger, a fire track, true fire.
Right, dope album. Each episode, we will bring on a special guest to join us to talk about one of their heat rocks. It might be a musician.
A writer.
Maybe a scholar.
I mean, I would have been happy to just talk to you about your heat rocks, but this is a different show.
Yeah, so I think people might enjoy hearing maybe the guests instead.
To do that, you'll have to go to MaximumFun.org. So if you want to talk about hot music, you should check us out.
Heat Rocks.
Welcome back to Pop Rock, and I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
Non-voting member, Sarah Gertrude Shapiro. Margaret, we got ourselves a book club. Tell everybody about the book club.
The book club, if you guys don't know, which I don't know how you don't know at this point, because we've been running this thing for like a good month plus, but it's Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. Bestseller, multiple books in the trilogy. Well, okay, three
I've
books
already
in the trilogy.
Ordered the second book in the trilogy,
it's
Rocketeers,
deliciously
because
fun.
The first one's so good.
Oh, good.
Yes. And I may have a special guest who could come, who is maybe in the movie, to talk about it with us.
If you
don't
say,
worry, Shapiro, he will not be allowed to vote on any subjects that come
fuck
up.
Him. Oh, it's a boy. I thought it was going to be Constance Wu.
Oh.
Okay, fine. Whoever it is,
I can't talk anymore. I can't talk anymore. But everyone should read it, so they will be ready for our summer book club episode.
Yeah, so get on it. The episode is going to be in the second week of August, so you've still got a little bit of time. But now is the time to jump on it, as well as Guy Branum's My Life as a Goddess, which comes out next Wednesday, which is freaking me out.
Next Tuesday, July 31st.
Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday.
I have plugged it too much. You guys know too much about my book. all right,
no
you guys.
Such thing.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the question, what is your current jam? So I turn to you, Karen Tongson, and I ask, what is your current jam?
My current jam actually is in honor also of Jonathan Gold, and because he was a music writer, as I mentioned before. And he, you know, he was credited, for better or worse, with coining the phrase gangsta rap. And he also even played punk cello in a band in the 80s. And music definitely guided the language of his criticism. But I'm not going to be sharing one of his punk songs or one of the rap songs that he championed in his early days, but a song linked to one of my favorite memories of interacting with him. And it was after I'd gone to the deli Nate and Al in, I guess it's in Beverly Hills, here in LA. And I overheard a conversation with these dude bros at a table next to me. And, you know, they're obviously planning some sort of big event. And one dude bro says to the other, "So does, you know, the name Lisa Loeb mean anything to you?" and so I posted, I was like, I wanted to say out loud, yes, yes, it does. And Jonathan commented on that post. I think it was on Facebook. And you know, and then he basically put me in touch with Lisa Loeb to talk about this moment. And so that's what kind of men she was. I mean, there was all sorts of lovely stuff he did. So in honor of Jonathan Gold, I think, you know, he loved Lisa Loeb. So I'm sure he loved this song.
so all the time, so. And I thought what I felt was simple, and I thought that I don't belong. And now that I am leaving, now I know that I did something wrong, 'cause I missed you. Yeah, yeah, I missed you.
And we will miss you, J. Gold.
That came on Margaret Wappler wearing a floral print on black, turned 16 right before my eyes.
And got my period for the first time.
Margaret, what's your jam?
My jam is from Demi Lovato, who obviously had a real tough time this week. She has been sober for a long time, but relapsed and was found, I believe, unconscious and taken to the hospital and is doing better now. But I am a fan of hers, and I have a soft spot for her. I think she has really been through the paces already in her young life. She's 25 years old, and she's bipolar, and she's been wrestling with addiction for some time, and being raised in the Disney machine and all of that. I think that it's been a hard row for her, and I always just appreciate the kind of, like, real soul and honesty that she can bring to her music. And this is a song called Sober that she released at the end of June that really dives deep into her own struggles.
Call me when it's over, 'cause I'm dying inside. Wake me when the shakes are gone and the cold sweats disappear. Call me when it's over and myself has reappeared. I don't know why I do it every time. It's only when I'm lonely. Sometimes I just wanna cave and I don't wanna fight. I try just hold me.
So for those of you who don't remember who, she was our first Summer Jam pick. So as we're closing in on Summer Jam season, we're going to run that show, what, in early August or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm feeling for her again, and especially with her recent relapse, and I just hope she gets her feet back on the ground.
I love her support. Go to her. SGS, you got a jam?
I do. I've been sort of watching it a lot. I've been writing a lot recently, and I sometimes just need to, you know, take a break. This is Nina Simone live from the Harlem Festival in 1969.
I got my hair on my head, my brain, my ears, my eyes, my nose, and my mouth. I got my
my liver.
I love the liver on that song so much.
I have to say, yeah. So I was thinking about, like, what is it about this? I mean, I watch it over and over and over again, and this fucking person is just so incredible. I think, you know, I was thinking about, like, her refusal to court affection.
Yeah.
I mean, that stance and her stare and the way she lives in her body is so fucking inspiring. And I think, you know, I was really thinking about what is it about this song, and for me it's like a total insistence on joy in the face of oppression.
Yeah.
And it blows my mind and just rips my heart in half. And I love her and miss her and wish she was still here.
That was really great. All right, from Mind Jam, I hand it over to Margaret Wappler. She will act as my proxy to submit something as Summer Jam.
That's right. Guy didn't have a jam this week, and so I said, let me play you a jam that I believe will be quite your fancy. So here is Zed and a country lady singing Meet Me in the Middle.
We meant all good intentions. So pull me closer. Why don't you pull me close? Why don't you come on over? I can't just let you go. Oh, baby. Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little. So why don't
in
you
the middle?
Rose and Martin, just a middle.
Great work, Margaret Wappler. I'm so glad that was my jam this week, because it really will be from now on.
Good.
You guys have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler and Karen Tongson, and our very special guest, the thoroughly delightful Sarah Gertrude Shapiro.
Woo-woo.
Sarah, where can people learn more about you?
IMDb. I don't know.
Google her.
Google me.
Watch her goddamn television program.
Yes. I have to say, actually, Google me was a line in the pilot of Unreal for a long ass time. So I'm just going to leave it with Google me.
Fair. Fair. Our theme music is Party Boot Chat by Ozzy Muzo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we would like to thank Sweet Babu and Buzzy B. They said, heard Guy on Pop Culture Happy Hour recently and finally got around to trying this podcast. And last week, I've listened back through 2016. That's impressive.
That is.
If you love Pop Culture Happy Hour or Slate's Culture Gab Fest, but they think they could feel more gay, and I do, then this will fill that hole in your life. I'm so in love with the members of this round table. I just hope that this podcast is around forever. If you want this podcast to be around forever, please review us on iTunes and give us 5 stars, because Margaret's health is in the balance.
Guys, I had a headache earlier today, and I didn't like
She's got a dog and a child now. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pod Rocket, or join in our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. Our show is edited by Shayna Deloria, whom I still have not met, and our senior producer is Laura Swisher, who I've met a lot.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.